Mr. Innes, Reel 5. We were talking about the engine room crew, and you'd mentioned some of the officers. Can you tell me, or give me a wider description of the numbers and the ranks of the people who were in the engine room?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not quite certain on the numbers of stokers, etc., but we'd have about five ERAs, one engineer officer. This was in the engine room. And that was all. We did all our own electrical work. They brought in what they called an HPE ERA, high power electrics. Normally that would bring an EE, electrical artificer. But he was from a different department, and they wanted the engine room to be self-contained, so they weren't bringing outsiders in. And that's about all. And you had them distributed through the tunnel shafts and in the gearing room, usually a leading stoker and a stoker in the gear room. Then had somebody in the shaft tunnel watching the bearings, that, and somebody on the steering flat watching the steering motors. Every angle was covered. And at sea, when the ship went into action, normally in peacetime you carried two changes of watch, but in wartime they brought three in. Now when you went into action, you went to action stations, the engine room crews were split up into three sections on damage control duties. So you only had one complete engine room crew down below. You had the other two scattered around the ship. So if the whole engine room crew was wiped out, you had another full contingent to take over. It was well organised, highly organised. Even moving around the ship was organised. You went up the starboard side and come down the port side to prevent people clashing. When you go into action stations, say there's a crew of 600 close on, you've got to move their men in about 3 minutes. That ship's ready for action. All doors are closed. Signals come back from each section reporting damage control door closed so-and-so, so-and-so to the main headquarters, and the ship's sailed for action. And all this can be accomplished from nothing in about 3 or 4 minutes. They're all closed up. All doors shut. Ship's ready, sailed for action.
What kind of duties would you be performing in the engine room at any given time?
My job in latter years, once I got my watchkeeping certificate, I was throttle ERA. I was on one of the throttles of the turbines, controlling the revolutions. You used to get your orders, come down from the bridge, turn at 220. Takanoni used to call it 220. Now it cut the engine down to 220 revs. And it would just say increase to 250. And you repeat, and all this went back to the bridge. Now at the end of the watch, this was the problem. You had to keep very accurate records of the revolutions turned. Because if you had excess revs, the ERA taken over would refuse to take over. Because it meant he had to alter them revolutions and rely on the bridge not picking it up, that somebody was reducing. And you're allowed a margin of about 5 or 6 revolutions on a watch. So he had to be constantly checking revolutions. Full-time job. Another interesting thing happened here. On that particular ship, they had a turbine stop on them. Now, never had they known a turbine stop, because the Navy maintenance and everything's spot on. It's impossible for the thing to break down. The checks are so regular, everything's covered. They check bolts every now and again in pipes. Everything's thorough. Anyway, this stopped. Wouldn't move. So the Commander E, I think we were going into Port Chufik, a turbine stopped. They sent for the Commander E, came down below, and they said, right, put 5 pound of steam on. It should move with less than that. Nothing happened. Put it up to 10. Nothing happened. Put it up to 15. Nothing happened. Cut it. Didn't go any higher, do damage here. They go into port. And there's lots of theories as to what had happened here. So at any rate, the first thing they said, we'll have to lift the turbine casing, which is never ever done. It never goes wrong. At any rate, when they lift the turbine casing, they flew engineer admirals out to solve this problem. When they opened the turbine casing, the shrouding ring on the blades was slightly burred on the knife edge. That was the problem. The casing had contracted, come down on the rotor, and because there's many blades, you had to have like a real solid break here. So then the theory was, well, how could that happen? Well, the throttle ERA, down below him, he stands on a grating, down below there's a cylinder with a sight glass on. And the throttle ERA has to keep half a glass of water in that. It's the drain from the gland of the turbine. Keep half. So while you're on watch, you're keeping an eye on that, keeping the revs, keeping looking down there, say that's right. Well, anyway, at the particular lad on watch, something went wrong. He looked down below, saw an empty glass. So he shut the drain in to bring the water level up. This all came out later. Right. That was the cause of the problem. Now, why should this happen? Now, believe it or not, this happened through a sight board being missing. It was a new ship. She only lasted 2 years. I think she was about 18 months old when this happened. There was no sight board behind. So when you look through this glass, if the sight board's behind, the diagonal lines go the opposite way where the water is. Well, that had been forgotten. A tuppenny board caused all that major trouble. Right? So then there was a panic. Put the boards on, that was it. Just through an absence of a sideboard caused all that problem. People being flown out, panic. And when it was all finished, these admiral fellas gave a lecture, you know, thanking everybody for the work and getting it put right. Because before they came to lifting the turbine casing, they pulled the big throttle valve down. They thought it must be no steam getting through there. They had this down, pipes checked. And it came to ultimately, we've got to lift that casing, never done as I mentioned before. And that was that.
Was this the Naiad?
The Naiad, yes.
Again, down in the engine room area, the stokers and so forth would constantly go around greasing and oiling things. Was that a constant factor?
There's very little maintenance to do in the engine room, really. You just stay in case of breakdowns. Once the thing's running, it's in the boiler room, because they're independent, they're all sealed off.
And was it to diesel engines?
No, turbine. Uh-huh. Two engine rooms and two boiler rooms. They're all divided off, so if one gets hit, you've still got the other, you know.
I think you mentioned to me that in action you were locked in, as it were.
Yes, everybody's sealed in. The gun crews are buttoned in the turrets. The men in the ammunition rooms where the lips come down to take the shells up the guns, they're all sealed in. And one of my jobs as damage control, I used to go to, I think it was Air Turret, as magazine flooding. And my job was to lie on the deck. If the deck got heated, I opened a valve and sprayed water down there. Because there's men down there, you see. If the heating continued, you had to flood. That means you would drown them. Because if you didn't do that, the ship would go up. It'd obviously have a fire down there, you see. Well, anyway, every time I went up there, and you went into action, and it was on the seaman's mess deck, and on the side that all the mess trap, there was racks fitted with all the vinegar, bottles of sauce, tea cups, all this on that. The first salvo, all this lot used to smash up. They were welded on. Every time they all come down, smash on the deck. There was vinegar, salt, all kinds of soups, all swilling around. And you're lying in this muck. And then every now and again, when the turret fired so many shells, they've got to open the door on the base of the turret, and all the shell cases come out. They fall down into this mess, and they're hot and sizzling. They're rolling about with the ship. You're trying to dodge this. Every time that happened, and all the mess traps come down, go into port, all welded up again. Next time, bash down again.
We can talk in general terms about actions before coming to specifics. Going into action, knowing you were going into action, what kind of precautions were taken against damage by shell or fire? Or did you have pipelines laid out? Did you have, obviously, medical items ready to hand? You know,
well, That I wouldn't be aware of that, but no doubt that would be fully covered by the sick beer people there. But as soon as you cleared port, the action, the signal would come around, prepare ship for sea defence stations. And then you had to close all A, I think it was A and B doors. They were doors that opened on the outer deck, and all ports and scuttles had to be closed. That's the sea defence. And the crew went to sea defence stations. I think it was more or less normal routine. That was that. And then when you went to action stations, all the other doors, close all X and Y doors, harness the action station, the sirens would go. And you were allowed 3 minutes to get through these doors, then they were closed. And nobody could open them until you got control from the damage control people. But there would invariably be one seaman, and you could hear the report coming through, seaman AB so-and-so hasn't reported for station. Oh, he's so-and-so, he's trapped, he can't get through that door. And then you come, permission to open X door, so-and-so, bulkhead, open, and he got through. He'd probably get charged for being late or something. But other than that, I think everything was all pre-laid down. When we so, went...
So that you, in effect, in action, you were trapped in your area.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. You can't get out. And the hatch can only be opened from the top.
So if the ship was hit and, say, it was sinking slowly, how did you get out?
Well,
how could you get out?
If it's a compartment flooding, they won't open it because the ship's going to be lost. You've got to keep the ship as a fighting unit. Therefore, you've got to write them men off. If there's anybody fastened down below, they're written off. Oh, yeah. The ship's got to be kept afloat to keep action going.
It must have been always at the back of your mind when there was dangerous situations that you may be trapped, not get out.
Well, it didn't affect me, but some were affected, and they got what they went bomb happy with a continual bombing, which every time you went out, you were under aerial attack after about the second day. And a lot were eventually sent off, they just become deranged. And as I mentioned with that senior engineer, he was affected with this, but probably not bad enough to send off. Or maybe his service was so valuable they couldn't replace him, they kept him there.
Was there a feeling of claustrophobia sometimes?
Not with me. But we did have a case where a lad, and rather funny, when the ship was lost, it turned out completely opposite to what you'd have expected. He'd been on a destroyer that was lost. He'd been down below, and he was looking to get out. The floor plates had blown up, and his legs were badly cut. Terrible. At any rate, he never got any... They got survivor's leave. He didn't get any. He was drafted straight to us. But when we were at sea, he never slept. He never laid down. He slept, but he never laid down. He used to go sleeping, standing up. When you went action stations, he'd probably be forward. He'd be standing in the corridor, and seamen would be walking past to get to their station. He'd be sound asleep, and he used to go right over, but he never fell over, and he was asleep. Bundle of nerves. Man called Tucker. Anyway, when the ship was hit, completely changed. He did everything he was supposed to do, got on top of the boilers, shut the main stops, and got out. He's since died. He got a lot of oil fuel, and his wife, I met his wife by chance in the Naval Club at Sunderland, and I was telling her what had happened. And she said, you know, he's never told me that. She said, I wish my son had been here so he could hear what his father had done. Yeah. I said, well, that's what happened.
Could we come back now to more of the activity on board the ship under the general circumstances? What was the messing situation? How did that work? I'm thinking in terms of your messing.
Well, ERAs had their own mess. They were a separate unit. Other messes, you had seamen, stokers, senior rates, chief stokers, and other chief POs. And the catering was all... We were served, we were waited on at the table by a leading stoker, generally a three badge man, elderly, done over, 15 years. It was a kind of a cushy number. And he worked in the kitchen adjoining the mess with a chief ERA. Now, the chief ERA was there to see that nobody got more than anybody else. This was the theory. So, And this duty lasted a week. Then another chief ARE had to go on the job, you know, for the next, to look after the grub.
So, as you say, you were served, and it was cooked for you, your meal?
Oh, yes. Meals was all cooked in a central galley, and it was carried by this leading hand to the mess, and he dished it out along with the supervision of the chief ARE.
And the seamen's messes, how did they function?
Much the same. One seaman was detailed to go at the galley to pick the meal out, and there was along tables there they were in, and the fellow would be at the top with the fannies, they called them, what they contained, the meat and stuff, and he would dish it out and pass the things down. And there was a thing there which a lot of people don't realise. In fact, you sometimes see it up in naval clubs. When you pass through a seaman's deck, you take your hat off, or the stoker's deck, as a mark of respect. It's their home. And in naval clubs, you sometimes say, please remove hat. And that's why it originates. Because it's their home, and you're supposed to be courtesy. You take your hat off. And the only person that doesn't is the officer of the watch. He's allowed to keep his hat on when he carries his inspection out to see everything's clean.
How was the day divided into watches?
Well, we had... the ship was divided into three watches, red, white and blue. Then there was the first watch was 8 to 12 at night. Then the middle watch was 12 to 4. Then 4 to 8 was the morning watch. Then 8 to 12, that was the... that was the morning. 8 to 12 was the morning watch. And the 12 to 4, the afternoon watch. Then in between 4 and 8... was split up into two, the first dog and the second dog. So you got a different watch every day. You follow 1, 2, 3. And the idea of this, if you got the middle watch, that meant you were doing like 12 hours a day. You could drop onto 3, 4 hour watches with this setup. Like in merchant ships, they have a different arrangement. But that was the reason for that. So everybody got a share of each watch.
Did you suffer from seasickness, and other crew members? Was the seasickness in the Navy?
I had seasickness, yes. Had it in the Merchant Navy, and I had it on occasionally all through my life, but in latter years, not much. But it bothered a lot of, quite a number of people. Some senior officers, sort of bucket on the bridge every time you sail, you know. And it's, a lot of them, it only lasted a day. It was like mental problem. It seemed as though, I'm going to be sick, and they were sick, and that was it. The next day, that was all right, no matter what the weather was, it seemed funny.
I suppose it concentrated the mind in an attack situation or whatever. They never suffered from seasickness.
No, that's another thing, you see. Your mind's so concentrated on survival and doing your job, and one thing and another, yes. Yes, that would help to alleviate it, yeah. But I did suffer from it.
So you joined the NIAID. Do you recall your very first journey with the NIAID, your very first experience with it?
Yes, well, I don't know whether I mentioned this in an earlier talk, but I joined the NIAID with another chap called, I forget his name, Malcolm was his first name. And earlier, be coming up to the Med, we stopped off in Durban. And we went ashore for a month. And he went ashore somewhere. Anyway, when he returned the ship, he had this watch.
Oh, yes, we've got the story of the watch.
You've got
that? Yes, we've got that story, yes.
Well, he joined it. And that was more or less after the first week on there, this incident came to light. Because he produced the watch.
Yes, we have that story of the watch.
Yes, well, that was that. That was within the first week of joining NIAID.
So what history had the NIAID had prior to you joining her? Did you know where she'd been and what she'd done?
Yes, she'd invaded Jan Mayen Island and took some prisoners off. Jan Mayen Island was a weather station, German manned. Now, the story I heard about this is a bit unusual, and whether it can be confirmed, I do not know. Russia wasn't in the war with us then. She was on Germany's side. Well, the story goes that Nayad landed, took so many prisoners, so many were left behind, but they were flying the Russian naval ensign. So the survivors left would say we've been attacked by a Russian cruiser. Now, whether this is true, this is a story that circulated. Now, confirmation of this seemed to be when we were in on the Nayad in Alexandria, word came through that the Russians had now came in with us, and all Russian medals could now be worn by anybody that had them, because they were banned prior to that. So the notice was promulgated, all Russian medals can be worn, and there was going to be a celebration. We were the only ship in the harbour that could hoist a Russian naval ensign. Now, putting two and two together, it could be right. I don't know. There's all kinds of things go on either side, whether it's a bit of dodgy dealing, I think. But at any rate, one of the men involved, Jerry Fuster, he went ashore, an ERA, with the landing party. And I think he got a bit of a award, and we got a mention in dispatches or something. At any rate, he was the survivor with me, with the broken legs, who managed to get me and himself out.
Which we'll come to, of course.
Yeah.
So how long were you with her before she sailed?
I think we joined in the morning, and I think we were away that night, you know. They were short of staff, you know.
And what happened to you then?
I think we did just a routine patrol. Then the captain then was a Captain Kelsey, a nice gentleman, well-respected man. And we did a couple of convoys. Then after that, he was relieved, and a Captain Grantham came on.
Can you take me now into... You said you did a couple of convoys. Where were these convoys going or coming from?
Well, we picked them up in Alexandria to Malta.
What are your memories of that first convoy, your very first convoy experience?
Well, it was the air attacks. You see, the first time I'd been under actual enemy fire, you know, the bombing and the gunfire. You had to be very careful with the guns because you could run out of ammunition. There was just continual attacking. In one event, we were firing star shells. There was no ammunition left. Anything that would track the planes, you know.
And were these German aircraft?
German aircraft, yeah.
Stukas, were they, or...?
Stuka dive bombers and high-level... Well, occasionally we got high-level Italian bombers. But they never did any low-level attacks. They were way up. They were very safe. They always had a name. As they once said, you know, when Italy joined the Germans, Hitler was supposed to have said, well, we've got 2 million guitar players here. That's what he thought of them. But whether that's true, I don't know. Yeah.
So presumably in the convoy, you continued your watches.
That's right.
Normal watches.
This went on action station. It would break down from action. Sometimes you'd be down below for 24 hours at a time. And meals was passed down was generally sandwiches and cocoa soup. Passed down through the hatch, you know, and then sailed up again.
And presumably the instructions coming down from the bridge must have been changing very rapidly under air attack.
Oh, yes. Well, that's another thing on that ship, which I don't think they got in destroyers. We had a PA system, and they had an officer, apparently, who did this job on the bridge, used to give us all that was happening. Now, a lot of people down below thought, oh, I don't want to know, I don't want to hear. But they'd say, well, it's nice to know what's happening. And he would, come on, you know, there's two Heikels coming in on the port quarter, flying low. We're shortly going to open fire. And then a fire would start, you know. Or he says, they've missed, they've passed over, they're way down. Or there's another attack coming in on the port quarter, and that's what went on.
So you were kept really up to date.
Kept all the time informed of what was happening. Oh, yes. Very good.
And your task at that time was still as the...
controls, the throttle.
The throttle control.
No,
yes.
It would vary. Sometimes I might be up for it on damage control.
Were you hit at all on the first convoy that you recall?
No. Well, we were hit several times on Crete, an evacuation of Crete.
We'll come to that.
Yeah.
So you have bombs dropping around. Now, are there any repercussions down below? Do you know, is the ship veering or tossing?
Yeah. Sometimes, to give you a warning, we're going to take a hard starboard turn because the ship nearly turns over. You know, when they're swinging over fast at speed, so otherwise you'd be flung off your feet if you didn't get any warning. And we used to get a lot of shrapnel stuff through the funnel and deck housings, but no injuries. So I got the job of patching walls up, you know, with a welding. We used to weld patches on them.
Could you hear the percussion, the explosions of the shells of the bombs in the water?
Oh, yes, and the gunfire, yes. And the smell of cordite and stuff, you know. Oh, yeah, got all that coming through the vents, you know.
What were you escorting on the first convoy?
All merchant ships. We had regular ones. They had ships on the run that could do about 16 knots. Considered safe from submarine attack. But sometimes we'd go out with a convoy of three and lose the lot, you know. Some never got there. And when a convoy went out, it would be nothing to have, say, three cruisers and about 18 destroyers. Terrific barrage. But they could still knock them off, you know. Because they used to concentrate on the merchant ships. Never mind any other ships. Get them ships. They wanted Malta down here. They were the targets.
What were the duties of the Naiad in a convoy? What were the things you had to do?
We were the flagship. We carried the admiral. We led the attack. And he planned the attack. What were we going to do? One time we were out at sea with a convoy. I forget the ships involved. There was quite a big force, about 18 destroyers, three cruisers again, and they picked up on the radar. The Italian battle fleet was out and not very far away, was in range. So Bayern was then, he was a rear admiral then. He came on the blow and said, what we're going to do here? He said, I'm going to steam away, I forget the direction, southwest or somewhere, with six destroyers. He said, we're going to go there, and he says, then we're going to fire star shells. Now, he says, the idea of this is the Italian fleet will see us and they'll turn and follow us, which they did. So the convoy went merrily sailing along that way, and we had to run. These battleships were fast. They could barely catch up with us. In fact, I think there was some damage on other ships. Destroyers were hit, not safe, not sinking, you know, but hit with bits of shrapnel from these Italian battleships. They had speeds of about 30-odd knots, these things. Some of our battleships were about 18 knots. That old Barham was a liability when we went over it. Yeah, was eventually lost, of course.
And your actual task, you say you were the lead ship in the convoy,
right,
of the destroyers.
Yeah.
What manoeuvrability, what kind of things were you doing in the convoy itself as it went along, if I can put it that way?
Well, they seemed to keep a steady course. Just terrific barrage going up, you know, what were the 5.25s and multiple pom-poms. I told you exactly what type of guns were being brought in. As they got near the smaller guns, like the machine guns, you realise they're not very far away then, you know.